Australians are sick of it. If we're going to do the right thing by our kids and our grandkids and the rest of the planet, then we need to stop having these petty political fights. We need to stop responding to Tony Abbott's playbook and actually start putting some serious policy in place. And we have the technology available to do it. We have renewable energy now that is the cheapest form of new electricity generation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week was, of course, Budget Week. We've already had a podcast out this week, so you're all across that. The other major development of the week was Labor putting the final element of its climate change policy out in the public domain just in the days leading up to what we expect will be the election being called very soon. It's a big and important policy. I thought that I needed to make the time this week to get in Mark Butler, who is the Shadow Climate Change Minister, in order to explain what is quite a complicated policy and also to war game some of the scenarios that may play out both in the campaign and after the election in the event that Labor wins and has to implement it. That's the conversation coming up. So, Mark Butler, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here.
Now, for people who aren't following this debate as obsessively as you and me, your policy might look quite confusing to them. So why don't we just explain what the Labor policy on climate change is that you've unveiled over the course of the last few days?
Sure. Well, the anchor points have been out there since 2015, which is to adopt all of the best scientific advice to ensure that we keep global warming below 2 degrees. And that requires a government commitment to being net zero emissions by the middle of the century, which is Labor's commitment. And it requires an ambitious medium-term target to reduce emissions. By medium-term, I mean by 2030. So we adopted the Climate Change Authority advice that a minimum 45% cut in emissions is what you need to do to discharge that responsibility that we have to children and our grandchildren and so on. So that is the centrepiece of our climate policy, doing what we need to do to keep the country relatively safe for future generations. And around that, we've built an energy policy, a hydrogen policy, a transport policy, an industrial policy, and a land sector policy to make sure that across the economy, we're able to meet those targets.
So let's just walk through that step by step. So for energy, your first opening gambit is, let's keep the Liberal Party's national energy guarantee at a higher emissions reduction target. But in the event the Liberal Party doesn't support its own policy at a higher target, what happens?
Well, those are mechanisms. The energy policy is grounded in a 50% renewable energy commitment by 2030. Now, there are a range of different ways you can get there. You can get there through a market mechanism, the national energy guarantee, which people might remember was Malcolm Turnbull's preferred policy. It had every business organisation on board, every state government, federal Labor was on board. We wanted it to be more ambitious, but we were willing to sign up to the mechanism. So you can do it that way, or you can do it through a more direct contracting formula, really using the contracting power of the Commonwealth. The key thing, though, is there's got to be a commitment to a certain amount of renewables in the system by 2030. And that, again, has been Labor's commitment since 2015.
And the sort of flip side of that commitment, if there's more renewables in the system, there will be less coal in the system, right?
Of course. I think people are starting to understand that our coal fleet is getting old and it's getting increasingly unreliable. We're told by the industry itself that about 75% of our existing thermal generators, which is coal and gas, but the vast bulk of them are coal, are already operating beyond their design life. And frankly, they're struggling to get through each summer. Hotter summers are really placing a lot of pressure on these plants that aren't really being maintained in the way that perhaps they would have been in the past. They are struggling, and inevitably they're already starting to retire, and they'll continue to retire over the next 10 years. Most of them were built in the 60s and 70s. They're due for replacement, and we're committed to making sure that they're replaced with renewable energy.
And but the Greens have proposed that coal is all gone by 2030. Why won't that work? Why is that in Labor's view? Because you've not made the same commitment. You're obviously retiring coal plants and you're moving to a 50% market share in terms of energy, but you've not made an explicit commitment to get rid of coal by 2030. Why not?
Well, because we think the orderly replacement of the existing electricity system will see at least 50% of renewables in the system by 2030. Obviously, there will be continued closures in the first half of the 2030s. I think the industry has made that clear. So life doesn't end at 2030. Over the course, particularly of the first half of the 2030s, I think you'll see an acceleration of coal closures based on what the industry advice about their particular age.
And so what does that mean? One, two, three, four? What does it mean?
Well, it really depends. I mean, the industry has set out, if you like, a timeline for closures based on them all getting into 50 years of age or their 50th birthday, and then they close. Now, that's not been necessarily the experience of the plants that have closed over the last decade. They've generally closed at an average age closer to 40 or 41. So whether that really is the reality we face over the next 10 or 15 years is going to remain to be seen. It may well be that the closures are more quick or earlier than the industry and the market operator have set out in their various documents. But we'll be ready because we'll have a good climate and energy policy that provides good investor confidence to continue to roll out renewable energy that allows households to tap into new technology like household batteries. And is also hopefully really bringing down the amount of energy we use per unit of GDP or however you want to measure it, because we are still an incredibly energy inefficient economy, one of the worst in the OECD. So that's also not only an important way to reduce emissions, but a really critical way to bring down people's power bills.
Let's talk about vehicles now, because Labor's policy proposes a pollution target for vehicles, and that pollution target drives a higher take up of electric vehicles in Labor's policy. Now, as long as I've been in this building, this debate has kicked around about vehicle emission standards, about fuel, cleaner fuel standards. It's gone round and around and around, and government has not moved forward in this area because the lobbying groups are, you know, well organised and have held governments in a headlock. So what makes you think that you can actually get this done?
Well, I think the rest of the world has moved very quickly over the last 5 or 6 years that this government has been in place. And I think it's fair to say that this government has been asleep at the wheel on this. And we'd like to see Australia get back in the driver's seat on transport, if that's not too many automotive metaphors.
It's quite heavy
for
on
your listeners.
Oh,
you see what I did there?
Yeah, I did. I shut my eyes, but I saw it. Yeah.
Where we end up at the end of the second term, and I hope, of course, the last term of the Abbott Turnbull Morrison government, is that Australia has the lowest uptake of electric vehicles in the OECD, and we're now the only OECD country that doesn't have fuel efficiency standards in our vehicle fleet. And as a result, we've got hardly any electric vehicles on the roads. Pollution is skyrocketing on our roads, and motorists are paying hundreds of dollars more at the bowser because we have such an inefficient fleet. Around the world, there is this massive transition going on. 80% of the global car market now sells into fuel efficiency standards that are reducing pollution and reducing motorist spills at the bowser, while at the same time, there is just an extraordinary revolution in the industry going on that's seen really over the last 18 months or so. Pretty much every global car company lift their massive research and development budget out of internal combustion engines or petrol and diesel engines onto the electric vehicle pile, so that really there's no car company you can point to now that is doing any serious R&D into a new internal combustion engine. So really the thing that has changed is the rest of the world shifted, and Australia's got a choice about whether we keep up with that or whether we continue to take the Barnaby Joyce approach and sort of pull our cardigans over our head and pretend that we're going to stick with our 2007 Commodores for the next 4 decades.
But it's still, all of that is true. You know, everything that you've said is true. The world has moved on. If you go overseas, if you wander around Europe for 5 minutes, you are struck by the difference in the car fleet in Europe and the car fleet in Australia. All of that's obvious. But you've still got the problem of the Australian Automobile Association, the Australian Institute of Petroleum, and other, you know, car groups who have opposed this with every fibre of their being for a long, long period of time, which has resulted in the paralysis that I'm talking about.
And I think there's a really interesting debate going on within the industry. So for the groups that you've mentioned, there's, on the other hand, the NRMA, the biggest branch of the AAA, the Automobile Association for our biggest state in New South Wales, that is being incredibly ambitious about this, suggesting we should phase out petrol and diesel engine cars by 2030, or the sale of them at least. So there is, I think, a debate in the industry and in the community that has some vested interest, that always have a preference for keeping things the way they've been because that's nice and comfortable and that's sort of how they've been making a profit, versus those in the industry and those in the community that see this incredibly exciting revolution happening in every country around us, bar here, and want us to catch up.
But so you are guaranteeing that you will do this if you win the election, regardless of the pushback.
Absolutely, we're committed to doing this. This is the right thing by motorists, and it's the right thing by the environment, and it will ensure that transport does its fair share of lifting in achieving the emissions reduction task that we've got to achieve. I mean, this is going to be great for motorists. This is going to drive down their fuel bills in the short to medium term as we clean up our internal combustion fleet. But the shift to electric vehicles has some great things going for it from a motorist point of view. The other point, though, is that we don't have a choice in this matter. The global car industry has decided for the entire world that they are shifting to electric vehicles. Now, it's not going to happen next year, but it progressively will happen over the next decade or two. We know, according to every best estimate seems to converge on the mid-2020s, about 2025 being the time when an electric vehicle becomes cheaper. The ticket price is cheaper than its petrol equivalent. Now, it's arguably already cheaper on a whole-of-life basis because the running costs of EVs are so much cheaper. But when that happens, when the ticket price actually dips below a petrol and diesel engine, then things will take off very quickly. And we have to make sure the country's ready, that we have infrastructure for charging in place, public charging infrastructure, which is a big part of our policy, that we have other systems in place to reflect differences between EVs and petrol cars. And frankly, at the moment, we're nowhere near ready.
Mm-hmm. And sticking with stakeholder resistance, the other component of the new policy is the reboot of the safeguards mechanism for people who don't speak safeguards. That just means a set of rules that basically Labor will require companies to reduce their emissions by X amount, and if they pollute above the cap that's set, then basically they will have to buy credits on the carbon market in order to offset their liabilities or what?
Well, it will be there are two choices available to the 240 or 250 biggest polluters that are covered by this. This doesn't cover any other business. It doesn't cover farmers. This is a particular program that Malcolm Turnbull kicked off. It was initially an Abbott idea. Malcolm Turnbull started this mechanism. We're going to make it work much more effectively by actually imposing clear limits on pollution for these 250 biggest polluters and then reduce those limits in line with our international commitments around the 45% emissions reduction. Now, if companies are able to keep to those reduced limits over time by changing their operations to do what they've been doing in a cleaner way, all well and good. We don't want to hear from them. Just a nice report every year they've been able to do that will be fine. If they're not able to do that, then they're going to have to offset the pollution that breaches their limit. And there's a range of ways in which they'll be able to do that, but the major way will be using the enormous resource we have in our land sector to remediate our land sector and start sequestering carbon into the land again. And the co-benefit of that will be, hopefully, a remediation of a landscape that we've cleared very substantially over the last 200 years.
But they too, notwithstanding the fact that Labor has made it quite clear in this policy document that there will be assistance for emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries and that you will, you know, go to the point of arriving at the factory and having conversations with them about what their individual baselines will be. You know, it's very cautious, the language. But we know these folks, and we know that they have invested over the last 20 years far more effort in trying to stop pollution curbs than they have in actually transitioning their businesses, or a number of them. It's a bit unfair for me to say that. It's not true in all cases, but it is true in a number of cases. You know, as rent seeking goes, these guys are top of the pops. They're going to come at you post election in the event that you win and say, "Well, we're not going to do this." What happens then?
Well, I've engaged with this group, as I have with every other sector of the economy impacted by our policy, very, very deeply over the last 12 or 18 months. And they've made a number of requests about how we move forward. They accept that Labor's position on emissions reduction is set. We've made that decision and we intend, if we win the election, to carry that forward. But they wanted, for example, to work with the existing mechanism rather than start designing a brand new mechanism and going through two or three years of green papers, white papers, drawn out legislative battles. They want access to the international carbon market again, which is a clause in the Paris Agreement that Malcolm Turnbull signed us up to, but which is rejected for some reason by the Liberal Party. They want emissions intensive trade exposed arrangements and a number of other things, an expanded set of offsets in the domestic economy, which might include electricity sector. We've given them all of those principles.
You've given them a shite load, but I still think they'll drive their truck into you.
So, of course, the hard work will come to actually designing the way in which these baselines work and how they're reduced over time. And I don't think anyone underestimates the difficulty of actually doing that work and finalising the detail. It's very complicated and it involves a substantial amount of work. But I think the thing that's changed over the last few years compared to, for example, the arm wrestle we had when we were last in government, is that companies are hearing exactly the same message from their investors, from their lenders, from their regulators, that emissions reduction is not an option. Mm. Emissions reduction is a must-do, particularly for emissions-intensive businesses. Shareholders, investors, lenders, regulators are not going to continue to stand by and allow companies to do nothing about the climate imperative. It's not only an environmental risk. It's not only a risk to the living standards and the conditions of our children and grandchildren. It is now recognised as a key financial risk.
I agree.
It's now a key investment risk. No. And I think that has changed dramatically over the last 2 years. And you see reflected in the commentary of really our key big companies in Australia now, as you do overseas. Not underestimating the challenge of the task of finalising this detail, but the broad approach of Australia's business sector, I think, has changed over the last couple of years because of the message they're getting from their investors, their lenders, and the regulators. APRA here, ASIC here, the Reserve Bank here over the last several weeks, making it very clear this is a key financial risk that if company directors don't take seriously enough, will impose liability upon them.
I agree. It has turned around. But again, there are a number of caveats in your policy. And I've asked you specifically in relation to vehicle emissions, you know, are you serious about it in terms of the pushback? I'll ask you a different question. Labor's emissions reduction target is 45% across the economy. Given there are caveats and commitments to consultation and all this sort of stuff in your policy, do you guarantee that you will be able to reduce emissions by 45% on 2005 levels by 2030?
The 45% commitment is not an aspiration. It's not something that would be nice to achieve. This is a commitment.
This is
a rock-solid commitment by the Labor Party. And I don't think really anyone who is thinking about the well-being of our children, our grandchildren and generations beyond would expect anything less. This is a rock-solid commitment. Now there are details about this very complex policy that, frankly, you need to be in government to finalise. You don't have the resources in opposition, the access to agency advice and modelling and such like, and business want us to finalise this sort of detail in government if we're lucky enough to win the election. They don't want us to finalise the sort of fine granular detail about what baselines look like from opposition. That would, I think, be irresponsible of any opposition to do. So of course, there are some details about implementation that, frankly, across most policy areas, a responsible alternative party of government will finalise in government. And I think that's what business expects and wants us to do, so that we get it right, so that we've got the right level of engagement, consultation, modelling and agency advice. But that doesn't in any way dilute the resolution, the sense of resolve we have as a party to make sure we get to 45% by 2030.
Is Labor prepared for a revival of, you know, front page stories in the Daily Telegraph screaming about lunchbox taxes, you know, Scott Morrison screaming in the Parliament about a Borat tax? You know, is Labor prepared for what's coming in the election cycle? You've been through this before. You know it can get very difficult. Are you prepared? And how do you counter some of that quite deliberate misinformation that has, you know, resulted in the repeal of a carbon price already in the Australian system? How do you counter it?
To the first point, I think I would have been gobsmacked if they didn't pull the Tony Abbott playbook out of the kit bag again and start running about our attack on meat products. I mean, last time
the sausage tax.
Last time it was the premium end of the meat market, the sort of the lamb roast being $150, revised down to $100 again. Complete rubbish. It never happened. This time it's more the small goods end of the meat market that apparently is under attack. But again, complete rubbish. At Woolworths, for example, back when there was a carbon price in place under our last government, confirmed in one of the pieces of Senate testimony that 99.99% of their grocery items did not change one jot under the so-called carbon tax. So this is all just the tired old scare campaigns that I think Australians have seen over the last 10 years. And what I'm seeing at the same time this is revving up again, particularly as I get around the country over the last, again, very angry summer where 209 weather records were set, the hottest summer we ever had. We know from the Bureau earlier this week, the hottest March we've ever had in South Australia, my state. It's the hottest month we ever had, the hottest day we ever had. Australians are sick of it. Australians, the consciousness, the level of expectation for this building, the Australian Parliament, to do better on climate change is greater than I've ever seen. I think even greater than it was in 2007, in the lead up to that election. People, I think, are increasingly seeing the impacts of climate change. They're hearing the urgent, clearer advice than ever from scientists that this is a climate emergency. And if we're going to do the right thing by our kids and our grandkids and the rest of the planet, then we need to stop having these petty political fights. We need to stop responding to Tony Abbott's playbook and actually start putting some serious policy in place. And we have the technology available to do it. We have renewable energy now that is the cheapest form of new electricity generation. The hydrogen economy is now foreseeable. We can actually almost grasp it, a great opportunity for Australia, and we have clean transport technology if only Australia was able to grasp it.
How much of the program that you've outlined will require legislation post-election?
Well, we've tried to design our policy in a way that allows us to get on with things as quickly as possible if we win the election. We've lost 5 years under this government. Carbon pollution was coming down under us by 10 or 11% over the period of time we were in government. It's been going up ever since. And the government's own projections are that we'll continue to go up without a change in policy. So we just think we don't have time to waste. We're going to try and implement our policy as quickly as we can.
So does that mean more by regulation or more by non-parliamentary means?
Well, we'll obviously have to take formal advice if we win the election from agencies about what our options are. What we don't want, and frankly what business and other stakeholders have said to me they don't want, is this sort of drawn-out legislative battle that is all about the design of mechanisms rather than getting practical change on the ground, whether that's in our energy system, on the land, in our industrial sector or on the roads. People just want to get going with this.
And because the Greens are already sort of they've set the boundary of ambition with their own policy, and they are already squaring off against elements of your policy. I mean, they are your most likely dance partners post-election. Do you agree? Or do you think that the Liberal Party could turn around and perhaps come to the table on some of this stuff?
Well, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen to the Liberal Party if they lose the election. And obviously that remains to be seen. But if they lose the election, there's clearly a more open tussle within the Liberal Party, particularly I think in the New South Wales and Victorian branches, over climate. And I think, you know, if, for example, Tony Abbott were to lose his seat to an independent running on climate policy, you'd have thought that would sort of excite the obvious internal discussion that's happening in that branch about whether they should continue the Abbott-Joyce line on climate change or whether they should take a slightly more progressive conservative line on this question. So I don't think we really know the answer to that question. We're prepared for both. In the energy space, for example, if the coalition loses the election and actually recognises openly that they made a colossal mistake walking away from the National Energy Guarantee last year, promised to bring down emissions and bring down power prices by $550 and toss out a Prime Minister at the same time. If they recognise that was a mistake and want to return to the table, then we would work with them, because getting bipartisanship around climate change policy has to happen at some stage. I mean, if you look around the world, countries or democracies particularly that are making really serious impacts on their pollution levels are doing that off the back of bipartisanship, because investors have the confidence to invest in the new clean technology, make the big spending commitments that are needed to shift an energy system from fossil fuels to renewables. And at the moment, there isn't that confidence because, frankly, there's such a broad difference, such a big difference
between the two major parties. But in the event, let's hope for stability, there is a movement inside the Liberal Party. It is tough watching a party of government being unable to rise to this challenge. But in the event there isn't, the Greens are your dance partners. They're already setting the parameters of the post-election discussion. Are you prepared to be pulled into more progressive territory than what you have already outlined? Are you prepared to let them bid you up in the way the Greens bid Labor up during the Labor carbon price process? Or is it, take it or leave it?
Well, I think this week and late last year with our energy policy and with our hydrogen policy, we've put out a more detailed plan on climate change than has ever been put to a federal election by a major party. And I think if we're lucky enough to win the election, we'll have pretty strong endorsement of a very detailed plan. Now, obviously, if we have to take it, elements of it at least through the parliament, we recognise the reality of the numbers, as John Howard described it, the sort of the iron law of mathematics. But we will push very hard for our policy to be supported in the parliament, and that will include push hard with the Greens. I recognise the political reality that really they spend all their energy and resources fighting Labor. They don't try to take a seat off the Liberal Party by and large. I mean, they'll fight in Higgins, maybe down in Victoria, but generally they spend all their energy trying to dislodge strong progressive Labor politicians like Anthony Albanese, Tanya Plibersek, Jed Carney and the like. And to do that, they've got to attack our policy. But they're doing so on the basis of some quite bizarre positions that they've backflipped on. For example, the ability of business to trade in international carbon markets that are set out within the Paris Climate Agreement. And they supported that when we were last in government. It was a central feature of the clean energy package that they signed up to with Greg Combe and Julia Gillard, but now apparently it's an abomination to allow business to have limited trading rights in such a market. So I think there's a lot of politics going on, understandably, in the lead into a federal election where really their focus is attacking us, not on attacking the Liberal Party.
But how does the politics resolve? Does it resolve in the way that you acknowledge that there needs to be give and take after the election, or does it resolve in a way that it's the money or the gun for the Greens? You've got to, this is what we're doing and we're proceeding with that. By all means, vote it down if you don't approve of it.
Well, we'll drive a hard bargain on this policy. This is a policy we've worked on very hard with across the spectrum of stakeholders, with climate groups, with environment groups, with business, with taking advice from think tanks and scientists. We think it's got a strong basis, and we'll drive a very hard bargain. Obviously, the reality of the parliament will mean that those elements that need to be legislated will be subject to negotiation in the Senate at the very least, depending on the result of the election. But we're going to push very hard for this policy because we think it's the right one.
But if the Greens sort of face off in a way that, if it's ambition or bust...
Well, that would be an extraordinary decision, frankly, for the Greens to take, particularly given the historical context and what they did in 2009 when Tony Abbott was elected by the party room on a platform in the coalition of walking away from climate change. The first vote in the parliament that happened after that was for the Greens to support Tony Abbott. And we know, frankly, what that's done to a consensus around climate change policy here in the country. Now, if we're elected at the next election, I think the gravity of responsibility of the next parliament to do something here should not be underestimated. I mean, if the next Labor government is not allowed to make serious change in this area, I hate to think where Australia is going to be in 2030. And I hate to think of the scale of betrayal to our children and our grandchildren if, for politics, our government, if we're elected at the next election, is prevented from implementing this policy.
Mm-hmm. Two quick things. Do you want to be Environment Minister in the event that you win, or Climate Minister, I should say, Tony Burke? I just gave you Tony Burke's job. Do you want to be Climate Change Minister in the event that Labor wins the election?
That is entirely a matter for Bill Shorten. If we win the election, he's the Prime Minister. And that will be a conversation, if he wants to have with me, that we'll have behind closed doors. But the selection of portfolios is entirely a matter for Bill Shorten. Obviously, I love this portfolio. I think I've worked harder over the last 5 or 6 years. But really, it will be entirely a matter for Bill, if we win the election, to see whether he wants to continue with people like me in a portfolio I've held for 5 or 6 years, or to shift us around. I will serve in whatever capacity Bill wants me to.
And have we heard the last on Adani from Labor in the election campaign? Labor has this very strange hedged position on Adani. You're sort of against it, sort of for it, sort of won't foreshadow what you might do after the election. Is that it? Is that all voters can expect from the Labor Party the coming election, or can we expect some more clarity one way or another?
Well, I think we've been very clear about what the decision-making processes would be of a new Labor government if we win the next election, about the Adani mine or about any other mine proposed for the Galilee Basin, and that would be to make those decisions according to the facts as we found them at the time. And they are shifting a bit, particularly because of some of the processes in the Queensland jurisdiction around this question. Obviously, the state of the law and taking proper advice about legal options, if any decisions did need to be made, and issues of sovereign risk and such like. I mean, I think we've been pretty clear about those questions, obviously, as well as our commitment not to be making any public funding support or providing any public funding support for this mine. So I think that those questions about Labor Party's positions around Adani, what we would do if confronted with decisions to be made by a new Labor government, have been pretty clear.
Not really that clear. What's your own view? What's your own view about whether this project should proceed or not?
Well, I think my view about the merits of this project, or opening up the Galilee Basin more generally, have been clear and on the public record now for quite some time.
Mm. And what's your view?
Well, they've been quite clear and on the public record quite some time.
Well, then you won't mind restating it, Mark. What's
your view? Well, I don't think that there is a case for opening up a brand new thermal coal basin. I don't think it reflects what's happening around the world in the thermal coal market. But ultimately, the decisions that might face an incoming Labor government would be made on the basis I just said.
Last question, I absolutely promise. Do you think Labor's position that you may have insulated yourself slightly better with this policy had you produced some economic modelling, some sort of economic modelling as to the impact, and also if you'd provided a carbon budget which makes it clear what levels of abatement in what sectors that you're proposing as a consequence of the 45%?
Well, I mean, I think the important thing about our target versus the government's target, and these are the centrepieces of the two competing policy of the major parties, is that they were modelled. They were modelled authoritatively for the government when the decision was taken to adopt the two targets. They were modelled by Warwick McKibben. No one's ever contested that modelling. The government never has. No one in the private sector has ever contested that modelling. And what it showed was, particularly if the government continues with their policy of rejecting the ability of businesses to trade in international markets, there is no macroeconomic difference. Whether you look at GDP growth through the 2020s, whether you look at wages growth, the only difference is actually our target's better on prices. Our target is better on prices. So I'm very confident. We studied that modelling very closely in 2015 when we made our decision around a 45% target. No one's ever been able to question, or really even tried to question, that modelling. Certainly Tony Abbott didn't at the time. The Liberal Party hasn't since. So I'm very confident that a strong, ambitious target that keeps faith with our responsibility to our children and our grandchildren is entirely consistent with ongoing growth in jobs, in wages, and the economy more broadly.
And the carbon budget? Should you have specified particular emissions reductions booked to particular sectors? Would that have... Again, does that sort of provide more certainty around both your expectations as an incoming government in the event you win, and also more clarity for voters in terms of what you're planning to do?
Well, as an opposition, I think we have been so much more detailed than any opposition before about how we will, first of all, what our ambition is in the medium term to 2030, but how we propose that Australia get there. So much more detailed than any opposition before. I really don't think people can say they don't know what we would do if we were elected to government in May.
Well, that'll do, I think. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Catherine.
Well, thank you so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to Miles and to Hannah for production. If you like the listening, usual drill, please remember, subscribe, share, tell your friends about it, leave us a rating or a review, talk about it. It helps the viability and the life of the project. Well, we all know that we're like literally 5 seconds away from an election campaign. I hope you're all geared up. We'll be coming to you regularly throughout the course of the next however many weeks it turns out to be. I'm excited. I hope you are.